And there we go. Well, good afternoon. I think this is the fourth synopsis I've done for Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance. I'm not sure about that, but I think that's correct. And so I know that we did Housing First and Toxic Inequality, and I think there was one more. I have been reading books, preparing multi-page comprehensive handouts on the content of the book for 22 and a half years. Social justice books and racism and poverty and homelessness for over 15 years. And so this is something that I have done and I believe in. I do not present books that I disagree with. If I read a book and I just do not like it and do not agree with it, I will not present it. And so you need to know up front that I agree with the premise of this book, and I agree with its analysis of some of the problems we face. But I want you to know that most of what I say in the next 35 to 40 minutes, give or take, is not me speaking. It is my goal to let the author of this speak, of this book speak. And the author is Zach Norris, and he is the executive director of the Ellie Baker Center for Human Rights in Oakland, California. And this man, Zach Norris, has had a real history of community organizing, of helping people, and he is now the executive director of an organization named after a woman who was an absolute civil rights icon for that part of California. And so he is now the director of the organization named after her, and he is involved in community help. And I want you to pay special attention. I'm actually on page 4 of the handout. So if you've got your handout, turn to page 4. We're going to do a little jumping around. That's the way I do this. And I want you to pay special attention to the name of this book. We Keep Us Safe. And so it's a great name. Number one, this is something we do. It's not something that somebody else does. It's not something that one person does. This is something that we do. The second word is keep. In other words, it's hard to get there and it's hard to stay there. So we keep. And then the third word is us. Who do we keep? All of us. The people within our community. We keep us safe. What is safe? It is in a life that is free from, safe from harm. And harm is a very big word in this book. I really like the use of the word harm. And so the subtitle is Building Secure, Just, and Inclusive Communities. So, we keep us safe, building secure, just, and inclusive communities. Now, I think that the book was published before the current moment in our country, but I want you to know that if you hear all of the discussion of we ought to change the way the police is funded, the police departments are funded, we ought to do other things in the community rather than just send police officers for every bad problem. This book really was ahead of that curve. It says that we are asking the police to do too much, and we got needs for helpers throughout the community that would be better served if we did not send police officers, but other kinds of helpers. And so I really like this and this emphasis, and you will see that it really does speak to our current moment in our country. On the left side of page 4, I've kind of got what I think is the heart of the book in just a few phrases. This is a direct quote from the book. We have an obligation to make matters better whenever we can. This obligation is also to the people that incarcerated folks might harm upon release. Hurt people hurt people. But also true is that healed people heal people. And so what he's saying in the book is, if you have somebody who is incarcerated and that person is not healed in the process of being incarcerated, then that person can come out of the prison, out of incarceration, and bring even more harm to the community. But if while incarcerated, they are given healing, if things are better for them, if they find ways to overcome what led them to the problem to begin with, if, to use a very old word that is no longer the dominant word, if they are rehabilitated, the more current word is if they are restored, restorative justice. If that person is brought back to wholeness and health, then when that person comes out of the incarceration, they will not bring additional harm to the community. So this book is very much about what do we do about incarcerating people. Maybe we shouldn't incarcerate anywhere near as many people. And when we do, we should do things differently. So if you've got a pen, you ought to circle those two phrases: hurt people, but also true is that healed people heal people. Now, below that, I have problem solution. This is my wording from reading the book, and I did read every word of the book. Problem: our current structure of incarceration, police response, punishment does not make us safe. Solution: care instead of punishment might make us much more safe. And so the point of the book is, how do we go about creating communities where we make us safe? Now, on the right, and there are a number of stories in this book that really grabbed me, and a number of quotes and realities from the past and the not distant past. But one of the really gripping passages was about the dangerous myth of the super predator. And this myth was actually championed by a man named John DeLulio, who later led a faith-based effort in the George W. Bush White House, and he renounced his super predator moment, where he talked about the super predator. Let me read from the handout and then comment on it briefly. John DeLulio conceded that, quote, he wished he had never become the 1990s intellectual pillar for putting violent juveniles in prison and condemning them as super predators. I'm sorry for any unintended consequences, Mr. DeLulio said. And here's what happened. He said, when you have a teenage boy, it was especially teenage boys, and they got out of control, and they began to get on drugs, and then they began to steal things, and then they began to get become violent, and you had to lock them up, and you had to keep them locked up, and you had to protect society by separating society from these super predators. And so he was kind of the champion of imprisoning a lot of people. And both Republicans and Democrats, Hillary Clinton is one of the Democrats who became someone who agreed with this premise. It has now been looked back upon. Number one, it didn't come true. He said it's going to continue to see a rise in crime. It's going to be ghastly. There's going to be so much violence. It actually came down. But number two, he discovered that didn't help. And so he apologized. He said, I'm sorry for any unintended consequences. So that is a critical piece of the history and kind of the run-up to this over-incarceration era. Now, what I say is first, do no harm. Those with disabilities, for example, are especially vulnerable. There's a section in the book about how people who have cognitive disabilities, they're not able to relate to people well, they're not able to tell their stories of abuse in a coherent way, they are especially vulnerable for attacks and abuse. Consider that those whose jobs depend on blank, and I've got a blank there because this would affect a fair number of people, but think about, especially, and he talked about, servers or waitresses, and their jobs depend on tips. That means their jobs depend on having good relationships with customers, and it is a traditional hotbed of abuse, of inappropriate comments and inappropriate touching, and even leading up to sexual assault, stalking among customers who pick out a favorite waitress, for lack of better terminology. And so you've got to understand that we go back to the title, We Keep Us Safe. We have to keep our eyes open, not to the bad guy, but to the safety of the person. We see the people. And he also says, we see the things that led people to being the bad guy. And so we open our eyes, not as a police officer helper to catch people doing bad. I'll use a business analogy. You need to manage by walking and wandering around. You need to wander around your community and interact with the people in your community. And you need to be on the lookout for a person who might become a harming person, and you need to keep a lookout on the people who might be especially vulnerable to harm. So those are some of the elements in this book. Now, I've got some stories here on page 4, and the book is filled with stories, and I cannot do justice to them. There's a story of a woman whose parents were killed by a sibling. It's a gripping and sad story. He had been incarcerated multiple times. We could spend all day going over the stories. I've got just a few. Circle this phrase, the separation stories. He has a section in the book where he talks about people who are separated from their family. Think about the immigrant cages, and he talks about that. And then he talks about the children that were briefly separated from their families, and then they and their entire families were locked up during World War II, and they were in the Japanese internment camps. And so, again, the issue is separation. He talks a great deal about isolation and punishment in isolation in prisons. And he says that's the ultimate separation. I did not know this. But he tells stories about families that would spend 2 and 3 hours going to prison to see their relative in prison. And when they got there, the guards would say, you're wearing the wrong color clothing. You're wearing the wrong clothing. They could take your button. They could take your zipper and make it a weapon. They would turn families away for what they were wearing. So the families would learn to carry a suitcase with multiple changes of clothing. And all of this was the way to keep people separate from each other. But I'm back on the handout. So many people put away into isolation. And there's a wonderful... No, that's not correct. There's a terrible story about a wonderful man named Alan, who is a father who cared for his son, Jarrell. And Alan was what we would call a shoeshine man, but he didn't shine shoes. He cared for shoes. He was a shoe care man. Long story short, Durrell got into trouble. He got into more trouble. He went into a youth prison and then into youth prison again. And at one point, he stole a car. Ultimately, he hanged himself in youth prison. And what Zach Norris is saying is the separation from his family was critical in this story. He talks about the first impulse. This is my wording, but this is what he's talking about. The first impulse of police. When a police officer arrives at a spot where there is difficulty, the lack of how can we stop the bad from happening impulse. In other words, the bad happens. And the police officer is there with a police mindset instead of a helping, caring mindset. And so the book strongly recommends that we need some first responders who are not police officers, but they are mentally trained to take care of mental illness problems or trained to take care of addiction problems, to see the person who is causing the ruckus not as a danger intentionally, but as a person who needs to be helped and healed. And so he talks a lot about that. He talks about how in his part of the world, in that part of California, there was a time when teenage boys would grow up and they would go and work in the factory. And then the factory lost its jobs and other kinds of entities lost their jobs. And now, to use an old phrase, the teenage boys go hang out on the street corners, and that opens them up to problems because they don't have anything productive to do with their time because the jobs have been lost. This is a serious problem. But if you've got your pen, put a box around this next paragraph. It's disgusting. And I had a vague memory of this. It's about a man, I don't know that I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, John Burge. He was a police officer, a leader of a police section in Chicago. And for nearly 20 years, from 1972 to 1991, he was in charge of a group of police officers who, it is now known without a doubt, tortured confessions out of people that had been collected and jailed. They tortured confessions out of them, and most of those tortured confessions were for things they did not do. And when I say torture, I mean electric charges. I mean something akin to what we would later call something like waterboarding. And I've written this down. This is my phrase. Why the it's just a few bad apples argument does not hold up. When all of this came out, that police leader, John Burge, and the mayor, Richard Daley, and other police officers and police leaders, and the courts all kind of unofficially worked together to protect the evildoers in the police department. And this is a direct quote from the book and from the case. Their genitals were shocked with electricity, and loaded guns were placed inside their mouths and pointed at their heads during rounds of Russian roulette. Burge called the electric shock device the N-box. And you know what the N stands for. That story in the book He is not remotely implying that all police officers everywhere are this bad. But here's what it does say. A group of police officers for 20 years got away with this. When it finally came to court, it was too late because of the statute of limitations to find anyone guilty for crime. But later, John Burge was found guilty in a civil case and had to spend, he was sentenced to 4.5 years in prison, and he spent 3.5 years. And convictions were overturned because they discovered that, and one person had been in prison for 30 years. But convictions were overturned because they discovered that it had been tortured out of them and they had not done it. So those are the kinds of stories that you will find in this book. I've got a few more points on this page. There is plenty of blame to go around. There are bad police officers. There are bad money makers. But there are also people with good intentions who bought into things like tough on crime, let's imprison people. And they had good intentions. They wanted to keep the neighborhood safe, but they ended up making decisions that were harmful, full of harm, for the communities. And so that was very important. Now, I created this little formula here that's on your handout. You take poverty, and then you take away, this is part of the poverty problem, the jobs at factories, and you so you have lost opportunity. So poverty plus lost opportunity plus school debt, which is mounting high. And then add to it plus incarceration equals disaster for the community. Now, he says that our public safety model is actually a framework of fear. And one of the things we do, and this is pretty fascinating, is he says if you have a teenager who does something wrong in school, but not criminal. Wrong, but not criminal. They bring in the school police officer. They end up bringing in other police officers. The student is, in essence, arrested for behavior that should not be criminal behavior. And once you start the school-to-prison pipeline, once you arrest them for this behavior, you then take away the healing possibility and you make them harder, and now they become harmful people. And so we criminalize youthful misbehavior. He has a very interesting idea. He says we actually need some rules that we put in place for the students to break. And we put them there on purpose so they can break some rules and kind of get those wild oats out of their way, where the healing can help without it being criminal. I'm not an expert on that, but that was an interesting section in the book. All right, turn to page 5, the next page, page 5. Why is there such a shortage of housing? And the reality is there is a shortage of housing. And so the homeless problem is very real. The book has stories about encampments where the city would come in and take away everybody's carefully curated personal encampment. And there's no place for these people to go. And then they criminalize the behavior of having nowhere to go. Vagrancy. This is reminiscent of the vagrancy charges during the Jim Crow era. And it's ghastly. Well, as I read the book, I came up with two reasons why I think there's such a shortage of housing. Number one, the U.S. alone, among other such countries, does not provide the kind of help the poor need. For example, true housing vouchers usable anywhere with mandated demand for safe housing. This was in also in the book that we presented, Housing First. And the idea is that someone who does not have the resources to rent or buy a house should be given a voucher. And that voucher is given to the landowner, the landlord, the owner of the house, and that is worth X number of dollars, 30% of whatever income that person can come up with, 30%, and then the government pays the rest. This is, in fact, the process in Great Britain. And he says, we've got to do that. And that means that they're not stuck in a, I'll use a terrible word, a ghetto area where they cannot escape into better housing. And so that's one reason there's a shortage of housing. The second reason, and he really makes a strong case for this, is that the cost of housing is artificially driven up. Why? Because it's being, the apartment buildings, the housing is being bought by speculators for the purpose of driving up the cost and selling it for a profit, and then the next round, the rent goes up. So those are two of the reasons why there's a housing shortage. Now, there's a major section in the book that is about Proposition 13. So reminder, the book is set in California, and in 1978, California voters passed Proposition 13. I lived in Southern California during that time, which essentially locked in the tax on a property to the year the property was purchased. These are direct quotes from the book in italics. An example in real life numbers. Investment magnate Warren Buffett paid property taxes of $14,400, 2.9%, on his $500,000 home in Omaha, Nebraska. But on his $4 million home in California, he paid only $2,264, or 0.056%. That was in 2003. In other words, the money that California needs to run the state, the money they need, was kept out of their coffers by Prop 13. So, look at this quote. It's critical. From 1980 to 2000, California built 23 new prisons and just one new university. The bag of money wasn't big enough to build both as needed, so they said we better build the prisons. From the state's general fund revenue in 1970, corrections received 3.7%, while nearly 14% was allocated for the state university systems. In 2014, corrections received nearly 9%, and the state university system received 5.2%. They're not investing in universities. They're not investing in education. They're investing in prisons. And that is the problem with Prop 13. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to pause here for a minute and turn to the front. We're going to come back to the back in a few minutes when we get to the findings and the recommendations. On the front page, page one, underneath the book image, I say, what is the point? We need a safety force that is at least as visible and available as the police force. We have to find ways to care, not just continue our ways to punish and separate. We need to build systems of caring. On the right, why is this book worth our time? Number one, what we are doing now is not working all that well. It's time to try something new and better. Number two, we lose too many people. We cast aside and lock up and separate from too many. We've got to bring folks together to create safe places and safe communities. And number three, we get what we invest in. Where are we investing our resources? What are we getting for our investment? In the book, there's a great amount of discussion about the militarization of the police forces. Not the act of the militarization, but the money granted to police force to equip them and armor them for this militarization, and that makes people feel very unsafe. Now, what you have for about maybe two full pages are the best of my highlighted passages. You know how you underline a book? I underline with my finger in the Kindle app, and these are the best of my highlighted passages. I'm going to read just a few of them. When you see it in larger font or bold, I did that. Look at number three. There is no greater motivation for making America a safer place than raising two children, perhaps especially those who represent a trifecta of vulnerability: young, female, and brown. And he's talking about his own life as a father. Let me remind you of the background. Look at number four and number five. San Leandro, California, Northern California, put racially restrictive covenants into place in 1947 that limited property sales to, quote, members of the Caucasian race, and didn't begin integrating until the 1980s. Imagine how those white neighborhoods felt when they finally had to accept minority people, black people, African Americans. They weren't welcome at the beginning, for sure. Mostly white, more suburban property owners relied on racial segregation, rising property values, and low taxation, which benefited suburban areas to the detriment of urban areas. And let me tell you, that's not just a story about San Leandro. When Highland Park, right here in Dallas, was built, it was built with deed restrictions to keep black people out. And I moved to Dallas in 1987, and the top two country clubs in Dallas in 1987, the year before Ronald Reagan left the White House. So we're talking about not ancient history, but recent history. The top two country clubs would not accept a single black member or Jewish member. And so exclusion is a long-term problem. Turn to page 2 on the handout. Look at number 8. There's a serious disconnect between actual harm and crimes. And so there's a lot of harm done that is never... the person is never healed from doing the harm, and the person harmed is never healed from receiving the harm. Number 11, belief systems that have to do with the allocation of power, such as capitalism and sexism and racism, are also the cause of immense harm. But how do you hold a belief system accountable? Put a star beside that one. Because there are unintended consequences of capitalism and certainly sexism and racism. Number 12, in a system where the primary directive is to promote profit, human well-being will always lose out. Profit beats human well-being. Number 14, people of color almost always bear more harm, write this down, especially women of color. Number 17, in a punishment society, wanting to be perceived as tough on crime, elected officials, judges, district attorneys are incentivized to show high conviction rates. Number 20, John Powell He is an activist who insists on not using capital letters, believes the systematic exclusion that occurs with othering, circle the word othering, can be combated with belonging or strategic inclusion. This is the essence of racism, the othering of people. And it's a long and deep problem. Turn to page 3, number 25. I don't believe that we make neighborhoods safer by encouraging people to spy on each other and report back to the police. It does not make us safer. Number 26, when we come together, hard though it may be, we increase the likelihood of resolving conflict. When we separate, there is no such opportunity. We've got to come together and discuss what separates us. He talks about places like South Africa where they use the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for this. Number 27, 28, and 29, quickly. Currently, there's too expansive a view of the role police should play. They essentially are expected to ask as social worker, mental health provider, school discipline officer, vice principal. While there is simultaneously too narrow a view of how community members can engage and take a role in creating society. Former Dallas Police Chief David Brown, now Superintendent of Chicago Police, David Brown said, "We're asking the police to do too much. You shouldn't call the police when there's a dog that is out of control." Well, this paragraph talks about more of that. Number 28, when someone gets shot in our neighborhoods, we deploy law enforcement in force, but we don't deploy healers, therapists, and counselors in force to help folks deal with the after effects of violence in our community. And number 29, reentry programs that provide support with housing and jobs training for all who are released from incarceration and psychotherapy for those with mental health needs are essential to reducing recidivism and helping people become productive and healthy members of their community. All right, turn back, if you will, to page 5. I've got to wrap this up in about 4 minutes. I'm going to read fast. I'm at the bottom, some of the recommendations. And let me tell you that in the book itself, if you choose to read it, in the last section of the book, each of the chapters has his specific recommendations. These come from those chapters. We need community forces of care. In other words, not just police officers, but care officers. For example, mental health officers, de-escalating specialists, addiction counselors, and helpers. We need to improve teacher-to-student ratios and counselor-to-student ratios. Especially for adolescent years, our schools should experiment with rules made to be broken and adapted as learning experiences for youth, circle this, rather than zero-tolerance policies which criminalize students without giving them the breathing room they need to mature. We need to let the community be the decision makers. He talks specifically about these makeshift villages that grew up in Northern California, and the people need to get the jobs for security, and the people need to make the decisions. Even though they don't have homes, they've got what they've put together, they need to be the ones who do that. The human basics, the basic human needs as human rights, these need to be provided in our society. The list is fairly long. A home, health care, mental health care, education through college that is debt free. A brief aside by Randy. When we talk about free college, we forget that through the 40s 50s, into the 60s, a high school diploma was enough to get you a livable wage. Now it's not. So college debt free. Some kind of universal, guaranteed, unconditional monthly child allowance payments. You got to have money. You need to institute real safety. Don't spy, instead see. I don't watch my neighbors, I see them. We make our community safer together. Practice restorative justice. Circle this and do some research on this. He talks about, imagine what it would be like if a teenage boy steals a car and instead of going to prison, has to sit with the owner of the car, apologize, make amends, and pay back, and the owner grasps that this would help the community. That's restorative justice. And he says, provide a sense of agency. Agency is the feeling of being in charge of your life. And then there's a section on implement SEL programs in schools. And these are self-awareness. It's a whole child philosophy. And it is, I got to find the right phrases here. It's self-awareness and it is emotional training. So how to be self-aware and aware of others. Turn to the back page. I've got the table of contents on the top. I did want to point out there's a section on each of these in chapter 1. Who and what harms us? And in that chapter, he lists the harm that comes from capitalism, from white supremacy. At the First Friday Book Synopsis, I'm doing four books for 4 months on racism. I did Stamped from the Beginning by Ibram X. Kendi, White Fragility. Now I'm doing to do present The Color of Law and How to Be an Anti-Racist. White supremacy is a harm-causing problem. Patriarchy, violence, and trauma. I have 7 lessons and takeaways. Number 1, there will be harm. How should we prepare for it? Number 2, there will be harm. How shall we lessen it? Number 3, we are asking the police to handle too much. They need help. And the people need help. We need a safety force. Number 4, yes, we do need to spend more money for creating care forces and providing basic human needs. Number 5, we need to establish practices of restorative justice. Number 6, we need to be more than a little bold. He recommends that we close all youth prisons entirely. We must close all youth prisons and replace them with community safety centers that house restorative justice programs, earn while you learn work opportunities, and wraparound services. And number 7, we need to know each other within community so that we can keep us safe. Well, that's the book. We Keep Us Safe, Building Secure, Just, and Inclusive Communities. And I am now finished. So, David, Nissi, back to you. Thank you very much.
Wow. That was incredible. Let's go ahead. Yeah, if you can't hear people clapping, guys, can see them clapping, people who are brave enough to share their video. So let's now go to Dr. Waters. So I think the reason I invited Dr. Waters is because I said, you know, Dr. Waters is the best person I can think of to connect this to what's happening in Dallas. So take it away, Dr. Waters.